Hi, just before you listen to your 3CR podcast, a quick message. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. Thanks for listening and enjoy your podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens.
So
are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passeran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by Mark Bray, the author of, amongst other things, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Yeah, my pleasure. Happy to be here.
I guess just to begin with, there's been a lot of talk about Antifa and anti-fascists and I guess people who are anti-fascists. I think it would be good to maybe get some of the terminology sorted, because if we're going to be saying this stuff over and over again, there has to be a faster way to say anti-fascist, doesn't there?
You know, if only history has provided us with such a word, that would be really convenient. But no, to your point, it is kind of interesting because at least in the U.S., there's been a bunch of talk about quote-unquote Antifa, as Americans call it. Not a lot about anti-fascism or anti-fascist, which is a bit of a problem, in part because what it shows is that for a lot of Americans, and this may be true in Australia and elsewhere, Antifa has sort of taken on its own proper noun existence that feels detached from a lot of people from its origins in being a just shorthand for anti-fascist or anti-fascism. Nevertheless, I think it's also a little bit, if we're really digging into the terminological and definitional aspect, it's also a bit of a mistake, although maybe a mistake that in certain circumstances is helpful, to simply reduce the term Antifa to the broad scope of anti-fascism writ large, because it really has come to refer to militant anti-fascism, which, as you two are well aware, is a specific radical left, either anti-state or state skeptical version of anti-fascism from below. And that's sort of what's been put in the crosshairs. There's a lot of misunderstanding about it. I think some people frame it as Trump and his allies don't understand. I don't think that they have any interest in understanding what it is, because, of course, they want to create the term Antifa as a catch-all boogeyman to repress the left and anyone who opposes the regime.
Mark, this is the second time that President Trump has made some public statement about his intent to criminalize Antifa as a terrorist organization. Could you briefly outline what it was that Trump said and what are some of the legal and other challenges that might face his attempts to criminalize anti-fascism?
Sure. So there was talk about Antifa being designated a terrorist organization. I think there was a little chatter 2018, 2019. And then in 2020, Trump declared that he would do it. Of course, he did not end up doing it in the context of the massive social upheaval the U.S. witnessed during the Black Lives Matter protest after the police killing of George Floyd. When Trump was trying to argue that the entire wave of resistance that we saw in the U.S., which is perhaps the biggest, most militant wave of resistance the U.S. had seen perhaps since the 70s, that was all started by Antifa, which of course is ludicrous in a number of ways. He did not follow that up with anything, right? The attempt to label the term Antifa as a terrorist organization was political theater, and the whole disingenuous rhetorical endeavor was a way to try and distract from the underlying social and economic and systemic and racial issues behind the protests. Now, this time he said it again. In the U.S., self-described Antifa groups have not been out in public opposing far-right formations for several years, really, to my memory. And that's partly because, with a few very minor exceptions, the far right, for the most part in the U.S., has not sort of tried to establish their own independent street presence in the last few years, so much as they've tried to kind of essentially, and succeeded to a good extent, in kind of influencing politics through MAGA. Anyway, so it's pretty self-evident to any observant person that Trump talking about this right after the shooting of Charlie Kirk, which he and his allies really wanted to blame on the left, although there's no evidence that shooter had any really discernible political ideology whatsoever, that's the context in which he's dredging up the term Antifa, which had not been in the news for a number of years. And now, legally speaking, from what I've read, there is no actual mechanism for the designation of a domestic terrorist organization. There's only mechanisms for declaring foreign organizations to be terrorist. And moreover, executive orders, which is this is the form that this designation has taken in the U.S. is an executive order. It's not even entirely clear, broadly speaking, what legal power executive orders have. And in this context, it's really just kind of a statement of, it's basically the equivalent of saying, I don't like Antifa. Now, that doesn't mean that it won't have any impact on how police and law enforcement and FBI and judges may view alleged anti-fascists. And of course, if we really continue at the trajectory of the march towards fascism that we're on, eventually at some point, the legal authority of this won't matter. We're, as far as I'm concerned, not quite there yet. And it may well turn out, if we want to feel a little bit of a glimmer of optimism, that this may be another instance of saying this for show, to show his base that he's really tough on the left. Remains to be seen.
This comes at the same time as he's also made very broad statements talking about trans people and how he wants to essentially outlaw transness. How do you understand the relationship between this recent attack on migrants and trans rights that have been going on and the repression of anti-fascists?
Yeah, that's a great point, and one that I've brought up to some journalists I've spoken to. You need to see them all as interrelated. I think ultimately they want, I think for them, the big picture goal is, apart from, of course, establishing the kind of social order they want, is to try and destroy the Democratic Party, either explicitly or kind of more implicitly by destroying their political capital. And I think from the right-wing perspective, the Democratic Party in the U.S. is this many-headed hydra. And, you know, one head maybe was the Black Lives Matter and quote-unquote woke or DEI, or before that CRT, short, you know, an abbreviation for critical race theory. Another is transgender people, feminism, Antifa, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the end game, and you see this with the rhetoric, is associating one with the other. So there were some tweets from Trump's son, Don Jr., you know, associating being transgender with Antifa. And he said, he called it like Transtifa or something, as if anti-fascists would have a problem with that, which of course they wouldn't, just to clarify for our listeners that are confused on that. But it shows you how they're basically trying to say that there is this sort of singular enemy that wears multiple masks. And you can kind of, it's not, I think, in its basic anatomy, all that different from white supremacist and Nazi conspiracy theory views from generations ago about the nefarious influence of Jews on people of color through universities, on gender and sexuality, trying to destroy the you know, quote unquote Christian family. So I view all these things as kind of interrelated in their outlook. But right now, I think that the threat to transgender people is far more imminently serious in the U.S. than this conversation around Antifa. And, you know, we're really on the verge of a great crisis that could potentially take on really politically apocalyptic proportions for transgender people in the U.S.
Given that Trump's agenda is quite broad, and anybody who expresses public opposition to fascism and or Trump or his policies may, it seems, be deemed to be Antifa, is it possible that he's bitten off more than he can chew?
Well, you know, that raises the question of exactly how much does he want to eat for dinner? and you know, with me, I kind of feel, on the one hand, people that dismiss the threat of fascism, that at this point is clearly ridiculous. On the other hand, I think people who say basically fascism in its completely full-blown form is already here is also not true. So how do we kind of balance the kind of, you know, it feels like this sort of almost schizophrenic impulse between things are completely terrible, but like they could be worse and so forth. So in 2020, Trump said he was going to label Antifa a domestic terrorist organization. He didn't do it. It was political theater. Nothing came of it. He made the declaration the other day. It carries no legal weight. Nothing has happened yet to follow up on that. Meanwhile, he's embroiled. He's, you know, he went to the United Nations. There's the controversy about the escalator not working at the UN. There's the thing about the, you know, allegations about Tylenol and autism. There's so many things going on that it's not clear at this point how soon he'll actually follow up or how much he really wants to actually meaningfully follow up on this Antifa or terrorists thing. On the other hand, another way of looking at it is by doing this designation and kind of getting it on the book, so to speak, that this is a meaningful political category of repression. It may simply be kind of getting their ducks in order so that when there is big, massive resistance in response to some sort of crisis, whether it be in the economy or what have you, in 9 months, then that kind of pre-existing label is ready to be deployed. That, to me, probably feels a little more likely than, like, tomorrow they're going to try to round up, every alleged anti-fascist. But, again, it's sort of hard to know because Trump is a little bit of an unusual authoritarian, it seems to me, because in the past, I think a lot of your kind of classical authoritarian leaders seem to have very specific goals that they seem very driven towards achieving. And sometimes it's not clear to me with Trump how much certain goals are things he really wants to achieve versus goals that he wants to be seen as wanting to achieve. And you know, only time will tell which of them fall into which category versus the other.
Mark, the book, The Antifa Handbook, came out in 2017. Much has changed since then, although I did see that there were riots, far-right riots in the Netherlands a few days ago that were seemingly spurred on by a fake Antifa page which claimed that Antifas would be coming, and so all of the hardcore Nazi groups had to come out to defend against them. Of course, there were no real Antifa groups coming, which did seem actually very 2017. Everything old was new again. But what has changed with anti-fascism since the book came out?
Yeah, that reminds me a little bit of, I was part of Occupy Wall Street in New York City back in 2011, and there was this rumor spread that Radiohead was going to show up and perform in Zuccotti Park, and like a ton of people showed up. And of course, it was spread just to get people to come. You know, so the whole, you know, I'm sure that an interesting little book could be written about the role of rumor in mobilizing people towards political action. Anyway, I digress. Well, I think that, you know, looking to the U.S. for a moment, I think much of what's changed, it has been as a result of the, let's call it, partial success of the general militant anti-fascist program, which its historical origins after World War II were as a kind of strategy and politics of opposing small and medium-sized fascist groups before they became powerful enough to gain entry to the halls of power, and then you have a repeat of the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And in the U.S., that largely happened. So, you know, you can look at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in August of 2017 when Heather Heyer was killed by a fascist as kind of like a high water point for efforts by the far right to establish their own independent street presence and political presence, you know, under the rubric of the alt-right to a certain extent. And anti-fascists defeated them. Subsequent efforts to try and recapture that moment failed through doxing, through opposition, and so forth and so on. And so you see that those efforts really peter out. On the other hand, you see, like with the pandemic in 2020, that a lot of far-right groups, you know, folded themselves into anti-lockdown demonstrations, anti-vaccine demonstrations, into MAGA. You know, January 6th really obviously emboldened them. And subsequently, you know, you get a few like Patriot Front groups who will do like little pop-ups. They'll you know, show up unannounced, do a little photo op, and then, you know, jump back into their U-Haul vans and drive away. The fact that they won't actually announce in advance that they're going to do anything shows the power of anti-fascist mobilization to show up and run them out of town. On the other hand, of course, we have Donald Trump in the White House, and his agenda is farther to the right, or at least more aggressive in its pursuit of far-right goals than the first time he was in office. So in that sense, obviously, it would be, you know, it wouldn't be accurate to sort of say, okay, anti-fascism has won the day, certainly not. But what it points out to me is that we're at a point where, yes, of course, Antifa groups will play an important role, not only in doing the kind of monitoring and agitating work that they do, and also in spreading the kind of ideas of always opposing the far right, the legitimacy of self-defense and so forth. But where we've hit the point where the goal of keeping these ideas and these groups out of the halls of power, we're beyond that stage. And so we need, you know, a mass movement to draw on vast sectors of society and figure out a way to actually throw a monkey wrench in the gears of this march towards fascism. You know, so in that sense, the stakes, the context, the goals, the strategies, it's completely changed in the US.
Mark, anti-fascists have been organizing in the United States since the 1920s, so I guess a century or so. They've also been subject to previous attempts at political repression. What do you think can be learned from those experiences and examples of how anti-fascists resisted repression in the past?
Right. Well, certainly that's true, that as long as there's been fascism, there's been anti-fascism. And initially, of course, in the early 20s, fascism was pretty much exclusively associated globally with Mussolini. In the Italian case, the kind of broader global generic fascism hadn't really been conceptualized for the most part. And so in that sense, anti-fascism in the U.S., as in, you know, elsewhere in the Italian diaspora, was largely Italian anti-fascist fighting back, of course, with allies from where they were from. And as it moved forward, you know, I'm thinking here, for example, of, you know, when there was a Nazi rally in Madison Square Garden in New York City in the I believe it was the early 30s, and anti-fascists showed up outside. They were attacked by police. If you think of cases of infiltrating fascist meetings and getting attacked by fascists, you know, there's obviously been a lot of violence directed towards anti-fascists by the police and by the far right. You can also, I mean, in a different context, fast forward to the 60s and 70s and look at the anti-fascism of the Black Panther Party and, you know, Black liberation organizers, where they were talking about the connections between the history of racism and colonialism in the U.S. and comparing it in meaningful ways to fascism in Europe. And, of course, the repression faced by the Black liberation movement was even more harsh and extreme, people being murdered, jailed, and so forth. You know, there's a difference, of course, between like what was faced in the 20s, 30s, and 40s in the U.S. by anti-fascists who maybe would get beaten up by the police and jailed for a relatively short period of time because of a kind of a riot or a conflict, and the kind of specter of being disappeared or being, you know, charged with some sort of felony or massive terrorism charge for organizing against fascism and the regime. So, you know, that latter situation brings the conversation closer to what it would have been like to have resisted in, you know, fascist Italy or Nazi Germany or even like Franco Spain or under the military dictatorships in Latin America. And I think part of the kind of difficulty that maybe the left is facing right now in the U.S. is that we, you know, the basic playbook of marches and protests, we've had a fair amount of that. Obviously, the opposition to ICE in Los Angeles and elsewhere has been really militant and inspiring. But we're sort of stuck, I think, between your conventional kind of opposition to a right-wing figure under a liberal parliamentary system, even though we don't have a parliament, but I really try not to grant the term democracy or democratic to the United States. So we're sort of stuck in between the business as usual, opposing a war, trying to influence public opinion, and of course the other extreme of underground resistance, armed struggle, life and death. We're in the middle. And I it is difficult to sort of know how to move forward. I mean, the best answer would be to organize a general strike and try and leverage our power in that way. The U.S. labor movement is stronger and more militant than it was a generation ago, but like we're clearly not there at this point. So we'll see.
You've alluded to this before, and it's present in Trump's statement where the term Antifa is applied to a broad cross-section of the population potentially, and was originally used by Trump to refer to Black Lives Matter protests. In terms of addressing these questions and the distinction between Antifa and anti-fascism and other struggles for liberation, what do you think is the most productive approach in terms of teasing out those questions?
Yeah, I kind of go about it a little differently depending on my audience. You know, if there's a bunch of liberals who want to basically conflate the broad history of anti-fascism with Antifa, like, you know, I mean, to a certain extent, I'm like, all right, fine. Like, you know, if you're going to show up in the streets, you're going to draw inspiration from, you know, the U.S. battle against Nazi Germany, then like, all right, fine, I can live with that. But, you know, it's not accurate to say that, like, the U.S. Army was Antifa in the 1940s. And so, you know, the kind of the anarchist in me and the historian in me shudders when it goes too far in that direction. And, you know, I clarify that, like, you know, Antifa refers to militant anti-fascism. It's a specific tradition that situates itself firmly within the radical left and so forth and so on. When it comes to kind of broader conversations around, when you bring in conversations around like anti-colonialism and anti-imperialism and other kinds of national liberation struggles and radical history, I do definitely think that there are connections to be made. And but what I try to, my point of view as a historian is not to say that imperialism and colonialism were a kind of fascism so much as to say that fascism was a kind of imperialism and colonialism, following Ami Cesaire and others who argued that what he called Hitlerism were European imperialism and colonialism taken back to the European continent. Just given the kind of historical trajectories, perhaps the overriding story of modern European history is this absolute contradiction between the development of liberalism in the metropole and the illiberal domination and violence and genocide and military rule of the colony. And I see fascism as kind of an offshoot of that. So in that sense, I think that we can definitely talk about anti-colonialism, anti-imperialism, anti-fascism in the same kind of conversation. But to me, kind of anti-fascism is maybe like the more recent little sibling, if you want to use that silly metaphor, in the conversation.
Mark, it's just been a few days since this executive order has come down from the mount. Obviously, the future is still to be written, but what's indications are being given about how people are responding to it? I noticed there's been a bit of a far-right media coverage, relishing that finally their enemies in Antifa are going to get theirs.
Yeah, well, the if it's any indication, the mainstream media covered it pretty widely for a day or two and seemed to be moving on. Part of Trump's strategy, which has largely served him well, is to just, what's the term, flood the zone, that every day there's some sort of new, over-the-top, unbelievable action taken by the administration that threatens one group or another, or one kind of established precedent or another. And so it seems entirely plausible that at least in the short term, it may kind of just get drowned out by all sorts of other bizarre, horrific things. That of course, is not a very appealing best case scenario, but it may be when it comes particularly to the question of prosecuting people for being alleged anti-fascists. I see, for, you know, from like kind of left social media and conversations that obviously responses range from the crackdown is imminent to this means nothing, LOL. I feel like the truth is in the middle somewhere, but what do you do about that? I'm not sure what can be done proactively apart from, you know, popular education and, you know, trying to teach as many people as possible what these words mean, what the history and politics of anti-fascism are, why it is important to oppose this administration and so forth. But I think we're a bit in a wait and see regarding that, while, of course, people are still organizing against ICE and against all of the various attacks that this administration is waging against, you know, vast sectors of society.
The anti-fascists might just have to wait for the late night TV hosts to get theirs before it's their turn.
Well, right, of course. And of course, there's something absurd about, you know, finally, you know, we've had years of genocide in Palestine, all this terrible stuff. But, you know, Jimmy Kimmel getting kicked off the air, that is one bridge too far. And then you get all the celebrities coming out of the woodwork. I mean, for what it's worth, it's a good thing that the popular pressure put to bear on Disney, including by the so-called Disney adults who canceled their subscriptions or whatever, that had some positive outcome. That's good, right? And it's good that there are everyday people who are willing to, you know, make the greatest sacrifice an American can, which is to alter their consumer preferences. That is a good thing. But of course, you know, I hope they continue doing it about other issues.
Mark Trump, as part of his statement, also made reference to authorities possibly targeting infrastructure, including financial infrastructure that the dastardly Antifa have built up over the years. I don't think there's any George Soros-like figure funding these activities, but I imagine there may be some ways in which the government can disrupt fundraising and financial support for anti-fascist action. What do you make of it?
Of course, the vast fortunes being, you know, tucked away by anti-fascist groups. You know, it is funny, also tragic, right, to look at how the right always responds to decentralized or radical left politics as not believing, or if you want to put it in a little bit more of a kind of skeptical sense, not acknowledging how we can do things without one big leader, we can do things without vast war chests or secret financing. Anyway, you know, no, there is not any significant money. You know, there is the International Anti-Fascist Defense Fund, which your listeners should consider sending some money to, which raises money for bail funds and medical expenses for people injured by fascists or facing prosecution because of their alleged anti-fascist activities. I think the closest that the authorities could come is, like, you know about the Stop Cop City protests in Georgia? Yeah, right. So, like, they filed RICO charges, basically trying to use statutes that had been historically used to target organized crime to go after the infrastructure of Stop Cop City. So, I mean, I guess hypothetically they could try to do something like that. To me, the language about the infrastructure and money, it's kind of funny because presumably the FBI has been investigating anti-fascist groups in the U.S. at least since 2017. At least you'd presume that since then they basically have a basic map sketched out as to what these groups are about, what resources they have, and where they get them from. The government has that information, but Trump and his allies are framing it as if, like, all right, like, we've done zero investigations up until now. Now, all of a sudden, from scratch, we're going to try to look into this. And to me, that sort of rhetorically frames it as this unknown, right? When Trump comes upon something that he wants people to believe, but he knows there's no evidence, sometimes what he'll do is to say, well, you know, people say, or I've heard, or I don't know, we'll see. And so that kind of creates that question of doubt, which is rife for conspiratorial thinking. And so I'm not sure, again, how much of it is that they essentially want to imply that this is some sort of George Soros-fronted paramilitary formation of the Democratic Party, as it's sometimes been phrased, or if they actually want to try and, you know, figure out, like, how many hundreds of dollars Rose City Antifa has in its treasury or whatever. So, again, we'll have to see, which is not maybe the most satisfying answer, but this stuff feels like it's very much in flux and could change significantly faster than things usually change.
Well, Mark, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us. If people want to check the book out, it is Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. You can get it in all good bookstores, but it is available for free on places like archive.org. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care.
Well, Andy, that is our program. We will catch you next week.
Yeah, we'll see you then.
Oh, and by the way, Andy, I know we were joking about there being no money, but your Soros check is in the mail. Oh, sorry, we're still recording. Hang on. Bye.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Kefirs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. from the traditional black and white keffiyeh to an array of modern designs. Explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. We're your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to keffiyehs.org.au. That's kufiyas.org.au. A 3CR supporter.